you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Indian Health Services has been in operation since 1955. Their mission is to provide adequate health care to Native Americans. We take a look at President Trump's pick for the new director and talk about the care the organization provides. Right now, research continues to show that blows to the head suffered while playing football and other contact sports can lead to CTE. That's chronic traumatic encephalopathy, a degenerative brain disease linked to depression, aggression, and an increased risk of suicide. Despite warnings from the medical community, many football players brush off the dangers of CTE. A new report from the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism talked to researchers as well as current and former Wisconsin football players to find out why that is. Luke Schetzel is a freelance journalist and contributor to the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. He's with us now in the studio. Luke, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, you talked to football players, locally accessible ones on the UW Badgers team. Mm-hmm. What kind of things did you hear about these risks that are all over the news?
I was actually, the first time I really dove into it was before their local media day that the team has in July, and it was only a couple days after a recent Harvard study came out showing that 99% of NFL players' brains they had looked at, and these brains had been donated, so a smaller sample size of about 112, 99% of them had CTE. And I was on the phone with my mom, actually, before I was going, so credit goes to her for the idea of the story, I guess. And she mentioned that I should talk to the players, ask them what their thoughts are on it. And originally I was like, players rarely even tell me really what they do in practice. It's going to be hard to crack that shell on this topic. But then after I hung up the phone, I thought, this is something that impacts them more than anyone else, so they should be talking about it. And that's what kind of spurred me to ask those questions.
And what did they say? You know, there's kind of two different things at play here, concussions mm-hmm. and what those consequences are and when players should sit out, but also subconcussive impacts, they call them, repeated blows to that might not be enough to cause mm-hmm. a concussion. Let's start with the concussion side. We always used to hear the phrase, got their bell rung. They felt a little mm-hmm. dizzy after a play. How did players talk about that?
So I wanted to get more of a feel. You know, I played football in high school. To my knowledge, never suffered a concussion while playing football in high school. So I wanted to get a feel of what it was actually like, a firsthand account of what it was like. So I would ask the players, have you ever suffered a concussion? What did it feel like when you first got up? What did you remember? What did you not remember, perhaps? And a lot of them said they hadn't suffered one since high school or since their freshman year when they first got here on campus. The seniors would normally say that. But then I was like, okay, maybe terminology change up. What's it feel like to get your bell rung? I know that, I played football. I know that happens, quote unquote. And then they would describe to me situations that just on the surface, you can't diagnose something through someone's just secondhand accounts. But they would describe symptoms of a concussion, which to me, my ears went up. And after talking to some athletic trainers, one at UW La Crosse, to kind of get an unbiased, out of the UW-Madison community account, he described if those players came to him and described those things on a sideline, that's something that would definitely they'd flag, go through the protocol, either rule in a concussion or rule out a concussion at that point.
What kind of symptoms were they describing?
Being dazed, dizzy. One of them said, it's kind of like, what just happened there, but then you snap out of it real quick, and if you can go, you can go and you can play.
So players are not thinking, I might have a concussion, I should go get the protocol, I should risk being pulled out for that protocol.
Right, yeah, no, all of them, in one instance, a receiver, A.J. Taylor, on the football team said he had never had a concussion ever, to his knowledge, and then described getting his bell rung plenty of times and describing to me the being dazed, not really knowing what happens for a second. To them, it's not a concussion, but when you look at the medical terminology that they use today, the term bell rung has been out of the literature for almost a decade, if not more. So it was concerning for medical experts when I would tell them that these players are describing the getting their bell rung, but that they didn't think it was a concussion.
Now, it seems like there are arguments among researchers over CTE, mm-hmm. its causes, how widespread it is. But it seems like what anybody I've talked to who studies this stuff says, if you have a concussion, you have to be held out until you recover. The worst thing is to get that second concussion while you're recovering from the first. And that's where the things you're talking about could get really worrisome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, concussion, from what I've learned from talking to these researchers, is that currently there's basically you're out 2 weeks. If you get a concussion, you're out, you know, that next week, you know, and until you are concussion free, or concussion symptom free, then you're held out. You're gradually brought back into practice throughout that next week. And if you're still symptom free by that next game time, then you can go. But according to Dr. Brooks, who's a part of the NCAA Care Consortium study, early indications are that there's still recovery going on in the brain after that 2 week period, even when you are symptom free. But there'd be no way to know that because you're symptom free. So they think possibly there might be a need to keep people out longer than just that standard until you're symptom free, and then gradually increase their workload again.
Talking to Luke Schetzel, he wrote about concussions, football, and CTE for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. He talked to a bunch of UW Badger football players, past and present, along with researchers and sports medicine experts. One former UW player who's taken this threat of CTE, turning to that now, very seriously, is Chris Borland, a UW player, went into the NFL, left the NFL early in his career, saying goodbye to literally millions of dollars. Here he is in a public service announcement about concussions he filmed last year.
My name is Chris Borland. I walked away from pro football and a $2.9 million contract with the San Francisco 49ers because I didn't want to develop CTE, or chronic traumatic encephalopathy, which is caused by repeated brain injury.
So talk about the Chris Borland story and his decision to leave the NFL.
Yeah, he decided to leave the NFL after his rookie year, and it was after a rookie year. I mean, he was a star here in Madison, but kind of a NFL draft afterthought, but because of some injuries on the 49ers team that he got drafted to, worked his way into the starting spot really early. I mean, he was on pace. You know, he would have been a multi-million dollar contract player without a doubt, and walked away from it all because of his fear of the potential consequences of head injury and how the NFL kind of didn't take it serious at all.
And you also talked to the person who really put CTE on the map and has been sounding the alarm, Dr. Bennett Omalu. There's a movie made about him called Concussion, right? You talked to him. He said contact sports and these concussions and CTE are the top civil rights issue of our time. What did he mean by that?
From what he told me is that predominantly in his experience, his children go to a private school where in California where their football team has been scrapped. And he's noticed that a lot of private schools in the area, you know, so schools that people from higher socioeconomic backgrounds can attend, have scrapped their football teams, guided kids towards more non-contact sports, whereas these public schools where kids from lower socioeconomic backgrounds possibly are, you know, pushed to play football. So he believes there's a socioeconomic imbalance between kids that are accurately educated on the issue of concussion or protected from head impacts and those who are not.
And when you talked to the Badger football players, I mean, you talked to them about concussions and there was that gray area, the ringing their bell versus an actual concussion. Was CTE on their radar, this long-term risk of repeated, maybe not even concussion level, head injury?
It wasn't. I mean, all of them had a really vague understanding of what CTE is. That's just a very bad thing. But, you know, a lot of them, you know, they're in their early 20s. They're invincible. And I'd spoken with Jim Probstel, who played at Michigan State with his brother, and his brother passed a few years ago from CTE. And he said, you know, all of these players, I've been there. You all think you're going to make it to the NFL. You all think you're going to make it in that career. And that's what I found as well with talking to the players, that, you know, they all think they're going to the NFL. They all think they're invincible. So it's hard for them to kind of grapple the possible negative effects they're going to have from repeated head impacts.
So if they're not changing the players, is there talk of changing the game to try to reduce some of these impacts?
Yeah, and you've seen this over the years. They have a targeting rule now in college, which they do not have in the NFL, which some people are calling for the NFL to adopt it as well. And that's if, even if it's unintentional, if a defensive player hits the head, like if there's a head-to-head impact with an offensive player when they're tackling them, that's a targeting call. It's a 15-yard personal foul penalty, and that defensive player gets ejected from the game. So it's a very, you know, serious consequence for that penalty, which kind of drives it home with the players. And a lot of players sometimes get annoyed that there's this ejection, but that's kind of how you drive home this message that the league is trying to send.
But the CTE worry isn't even so much about tackling. It's the collision between offensive mm-hmm. linemen and defensive linemen that happens every single play.
Right, yeah. And when you talk, I talked to a defensive player, and you know, he said he gets his bell rung, you know, basically every play because that's the position he has. But for him, his bell rung, he meant more so of like just getting hit all the time. He didn't necessarily think it was a head impact every single time. But yeah, I mean, offensive linemen, defensive linemen, they're right up against each other head to head every single play going at it.
We'll leave it there for now. Luke, thanks a lot for sharing your reporting mm-hmm. with us. That's Luke Schetzel, freelance reporter. He contributed this piece to the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, talking about why many football players downplay the risks of head injuries despite growing research on concussions and CTE, the brain disease. First, President Trump's new pick for the head of Indian Health Services, Robert Weaver, is pending Senate approval after some reporting raised questions about possible misrepresentation of hospital job experience he had listed on his resume. Weaver is a member of the Kapow tribe of Oklahoma and has a background in selling insurance to his own tribe and recently to other tribes. Our next guest has been writing about the nominee and the role of Indian Health Services. Mark Trant joins us now. He's a professor of journalism at the University of North Dakota and an independent journalist on his blog, TrantReports.com. He's also a member of Idaho's Shoshone Bannock tribe. Mark, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
Well, there's this controversy about this nominee for the head of Indian Health Services, and I think a lot of people without experience with that that organization are wondering, what is Indian Health Services? Can you tell us a bit about its role and its history?
Well, it's actually interesting because almost all of the media accounts of the Indian Health Service still write about it as if it was this giant government organization that provides health on Indian reservations across the country. And indeed, when it was formed, that's exactly what it did. But now 60% of the Indian Health Service is actually just funding tribal organizations that provide health care and often do a much better job of that.
And when I've been reading up on this, the phrase chronically underfunded is often used, at least for the past, of Indian Health Service. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, Indian Health Service works primarily with appropriations. And what's really happening is there's two things. One is the Indian Health Service, as we know it, the government doctors and the clinics run by the federal government only get those appropriations pretty much, whereas the tribal facilities get a great deal of their resources from Medicaid. In fact, in Alaska, Arizona, New Mexico, several other states, Medicaid is actually a bigger funder of Indian Health Service for these tribal programs than the Indian Health Service itself.
And talk about the different challenges of the Indian Health Service. As I understand it, you know, people might think, oh, this would be a clinic on a reservation. This also could be services provided in urban areas. This could be anywhere in the country.
That's true. But Indian Health Service, about 99% goes to reservation funding. Only about 1% goes to urban areas, except for, again, Medicaid would be an exception to that. One of the challenges is, I think in terms of story, is the Indian Health Service really has some chronic management problems. And part of it is from this underfunding, but part of it is this changing mission, where now it's not just an operations agency, but a funding agency. And the two ideas are really different in how you kind of achieve excellence. One of the stories that I don't think is told very often about the Indian health system, and I use that instead of service because it's more inclusive, is that there are some pockets of real excellence. In fact, better health care delivered than the rest of the country at a far lower cost.
Talk about those success stories. How did they get there?
They got there primarily by paying attention to what can we do with the resources. In fact, there's a great story out of Anchorage. The Alaska Native Medical Center is one of those really outstanding facilities. And when they were building a new hospital, they surveyed the membership that used it. And they said, what's the biggest problem with the health care you've been getting? And virtually everybody said, you know, we wait too long. We end up spending all day there and we don't know what's going on. And so when they built the facility, they built these really tiny waiting rooms and got everyone in and out, In fact, there are signs there that says, if you've been here longer than 15 minutes, something's wrong, talk to us. And they designed the entire system around that complaint. And it's really put the patient in charge, saying, I know what's best for my healthcare, and here's what we need to do, working with the medical team.
We are talking with Mark Tran from the University of North Dakota about the Indian Health Service, and as he says, the Indian Health system around the country. So, Mark, that takes us to what's in the news now. Robert Weaver, President Trump's nominee as the new director of the Indian Health Service. Talk about his background a little bit.
Well, his background is primarily insurance and insurance business. And most of the people who've run the Indian Health Service, well, all but one, have been physicians. And not only that, all of them have had multiple higher education degrees, such as MBAs or Masters of Public Health, other higher education degrees. Mr. Weaver was not a college graduate. He attended college and pretty much cut his teeth in the insurance business. And managing a very complicated science-based organization, that will be a tremendous challenge. He would be in charge of people running hospitals, and he would not be qualified to run those hospitals.
And there's been some controversy over how he's represented his resume. Is that right?
Yeah, early on, he tried to make it look like he was a graduate. And it was only after calls by the Wall Street Journal that found out that indeed he had been misrepresenting his college education.
Now, you wrote that maybe not this particular individual, but maybe somebody with an insurance background wouldn't be so terrible for the system. Why is that?
Well, there are two people that I would put really high on the list, and they're both former state health care directors, and so they've worked with Medicaid. And Medicaid is really the essential fuel for improving the funding mechanism, and somebody who really understands that could really help the system, I think, a great deal. Currently, the current director of public health in Alaska for the state of Alaska is Alaska Native, and she would be a fantastic director because of that experience.
Now, a question that might be on some people's minds is, why do we have a separate Indian health system and this Indian Health Service in the first place?
Sure, that's a great question. And actually, a lot of people call it prepaid health care, because when you look at the original treaties, almost all of them promise health care as part of the deal. So to renege on that basically would say we bought land that made the United States and promised health care as part of that purchase price, and now we're changing our mind. So it's kind of problematic. It's a very direct promise made by treaties.
And do you think that that promise has been kept, again, thinking about underfunding of the past?
I don't think so. I mean, in the sense that, well, twofold. One, the money is not where it ought to be. That's for sure. But that money is also not the issue. It's what kind of healthcare system do people want and what can they get there? And one thing that I think is really important to understand about the Indian health system is that if you look at health statistics from, say, the 1970s, in 1974, Congress passed the Indian Healthcare Improvement Act. The rate of improvement is stunning. The Native American population was like 40 years behind the general population in terms of early death, and now it's just 4 or 5 years. It's just this really stunning level of improvement. And so I think that's something that all Americans ought to take credit for, saying, you know what, this really did work.
Our healthcare system in the United States, the whole general system is, I think, complicated, fair to say. What would you like to see change? How could we take advantage of the innovations you've pointed toward and replicate them elsewhere in the country?
Well, we have so many institutional forces that kind of push back. I'll give you another one. We've found it's been really hard to get dentists to rural communities, not just Indian country, but all rural communities. And starting in Alaska, then Washington State and Oregon, tribes have experimented with taking young people right out of high school and doing high-level training and creating a mid-level practice. And it's very cost-efficient. It's much less expensive than a dentist, and it gets people with oral health. But the American Dental Association hasn't liked that idea at all and has been fighting it pretty much in every state where it's come up.
Getting back to the Senate now and Robert Weaver, his nomination as director of this agency, should the Senate confirm him, do you think?
I think it would be problematic, and partly because of his education, but partly because of misrepresentation. It's, if you're going to go into a Senate nomination, you really have to lay out all your cards so that people know what you're dealing with. It makes it tough on those who advocate for him.
Do you think this nomination is a sign maybe that the administration doesn't take Indian healthcare seriously?
Wow, that's certainly a plausible explanation. I wouldn't directly say that, but there's nothing to undercut that, that's for sure.
Is there any movement out there to try to replace Robert Weaver with a couple of the people that you mentioned that you thought would be better directors?
No, not yet. And part of the problem with this administration on healthcare is this really direct, constant attack on Medicaid. And if you look at all the programs across the country that benefit really a variety of people, but especially Native Americans, Medicaid would have to be toward the top of the list. It's just cost-effective in terms of covering people, cost-effective in terms of administration and its costs, and actually delivering health care.
We'll leave it there for now. Mark, thanks a lot for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Glad to do it.
That was Mark Trant, professor of journalism at the University of North Dakota and a member of Idaho's Shoshone-Bannock tribe. You can find him at trantreports.com. He joins us to talk about Indian Health Services and the Indian Health System and President Trump's new pick for its director. Now, NAFTA negotiations are currently underway in Montreal. The North American Free Trade Agreement facilitates open trade between the United States, Canada, and Mexico. Estimates show that NAFTA accounts for about $1 trillion of trade between the three countries. But despite NAFTA's importance in U.S. international trade, it has not always been popular before or after it came into existence. And most recently, President Trump used it as a political talking point and argued that the United States was getting the short end of the stick in that agreement and in world trade in general. Mark Koplovich is with us. He's an associate professor of political science and public affairs at the UW-Madison. Mark, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me again.
Well, NAFTA was controversial, not just in the United States, as it came into existence. Can you talk a little bit about the hopes and fears when NAFTA was signed into effect?
Yeah, so NAFTA actually started in the 1980s as the U.S.-Canada Free Trade Agreement, and then Mexico was added in the 1990s. And the hopes of trade agreements are always, you know, we know from economic theory that the idea behind trade is countries will specialize and produce what they produce relatively most efficiently, and that will lead to lower prices, more products, increased international trade, and that's good for consumers. It's generally good for economic growth. The fears and the political problems are that creates winners and losers within countries, right? If you're importing more goods into the United States from Canada or Mexico, that often is coming at the expense of firms that used to produce those goods at home and are facing greater import competition. So you get, it's good for consumers, it's good for American export firms, it's bad for American firms that are competing with Canadian and Mexican firms.
And on a political level, in a presentation I think you did on this, you talk about, okay, there's this good that comes out of it, out of a free trade agreement, but it's heavily dispersed. You might pay $20 less for the TV and a few bucks less for the toaster. That doesn't motivate political action. But the people who are hurt by it, who are laid off at a factory, that is a very acute loss for them, and that's more of a political motivation.
Yeah, so when we think about the politics of trade, you have these very spread out or diffuse benefits. We go into the store, there's more things imported from China that are cheaper that we buy on Amazon or in Target, but the costs are very concentrated. Right, you have certain industries, or you know, geographically concentrated, that an auto factory is going to go out of business, or a furniture factory is going to go out of business because business is picking up and moving, jobs are picking up and moving overseas, and especially in a political system where you have geographically concentrated districts, like we do in Congress, you get you get cleavages domestically, geographically across parties, that people are opposed to trade. And in general, we think that the losers from trade mobilize more because they're feeling the pain more than we're, you know, as consumers, feeling the benefits.
Now, President Trump has been making the case not just that individual regions in the United States are losing out on free trade, or that groups of workers, though he's talked about that. He's making the case that the United States as a whole is losing out in NAFTA, in basically in most trade agreements that he's talked about. We are losing one way or another.
Yeah.
How do we evaluate something?
So,
like that?
You know, President Trump and his trade representative, Robert Lighthizer, the Trump administration thinks very much in a mercantilist sort of way where trade is zero sum, right? If one country is running a bilateral trade surplus, they're winning, we're losing. That's not generally how we think about trade. Going back to the 18th and 19th century and the ideas of Adam Smith and David Ricardo, again, that you know trade benefits both countries or all countries, but that you have these winners and losers. You know, I think the U.S., Canada, Mexico, economic growth, economic activity over the last 20 years in the aggregate has not been harmed and likely been helped by NAFTA. But again, you know, you have these very politically sensitive winners and losers. And it's not difficult to understand why this sells politically, because you have parts of the country where people are seeing jobs moving overseas, plants closing, entire industries that are disappearing. And there are lots of reasons for that, right? It could be automation, could be globalization, it might be trade. But trade agreements are a very concrete thing that a political candidate or a president can focus on, is this is the thing that's causing the harm.
It seemed like free trade really took a beating in the last presidential election. It wasn't just part of Donald Trump, the candidate's appeal, but Bernie Sanders, his appeal was against things like the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Hillary Clinton was ultimately forced, it seemed like, to back away from free trade agreements that she had talked up in the past. This was a potent political force in 2016.
Yeah, and I mean, it's historically always been a potent political force. And again, if you think about the reasons why, the benefits of trade are widely dispersed, but political candidates don't get campaign contributions from, you know, the angry milk consumers of America who might be upset that milk is more expensive because of agricultural protection. But there are sectors of the economy and firms that are contributing to on both sides of the political aisle, and trade. You know, it's hard to be ardently free trade if the constituencies that you're depending on and the dollars you're depending on in terms of campaign contributions are from firms or sectors that want protection.
We're talking about NAFTA, free trade, the World Trade Organization, and more with Mark Koplovich from UW-Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and your questions. Want to get into some recent news, not directly NAFTA-related. The White House saying, hey, we're going to have some tariffs on a couple product lines, solar collector components and washing machines targeting, I think it was South Korea and China.
Yes.
Talk about, are these symbolic largely? Are these a significant financial punishment for those countries, and for what?
So there are a set of trade laws on the books in the U.S. and as part of our membership in the World Trade Organization, a set of temporary trade barriers you can put up if you are facing a surge of imports and for other reasons. And the Trump administration has announced that it's going to put up these barriers. What that means is that the prices are probably going to go up for consumers. The other thing that's interesting is, you know, for a long time, we thought about trade as we produce things and sell them overseas and other countries do the same. You know, with the globalization of production now, a lot of firms that are producing in the United States are importing inputs into production from overseas. So the idea that this is going to create jobs or help the American economy, it's difficult to see that, because actually what it's going to do is raise the price of solar panels. It's going to raise the price of washing machines. That may help Whirlpool. And it may help geographically to save a few jobs. But what I've seen in the news in terms of the solar industry is that's going to raise the cost of production. That's going to lead to declines in construction that may hurt economic growth. It's not as easy to say we're protecting jobs at home now when firms, right, that contribute to growth and employment now are going to face higher costs on their imported inputs.
Let's talk about China a little bit. A lot of people, and this is not just President Trump, have said China is playing kind of dirty, even under the terms of the World Trade Organization and various agreements. In the past, they had manipulated currency to their benefit. Now they have these barriers, among other things, saying you want to sell here, you want to build here. Great. Share your trade secrets with us. A lot of state support for industries. Is it fair to say China is cheating a little bit?
I think it's fair to say China's cheating a little bit. It's obviously, you know, it gets complicated in the sense that all countries cheat to some extent, right? And part of the reason that we have a rules-based international trade regime with the World Trade Organization and trade agreements like NAFTA is to set up dispute settlement mechanisms and rules for what happens if countries cheat. Right, that we don't want to get into trade wars where we're putting up massive tariff walls and disrupting trade, that the U.S. can take China to the court in Geneva in the World Trade Organization, or can take Canada and Mexico to the NAFTA dispute court. So, you know, in the past, China was undervaluing its currency. They do subsidize certain sectors. They do, you know, they haven't lived up to all their WTO obligations. But that's actually true of the U.S., it's true of the EU, it's true of Canada, that countries don't fully comply with the rules of international trade. And that's why the U.S. and the sort of major economies of the world have championed since the 1940s having international organizations with rules and dispute settlement mechanisms. And so the big departure with the Trump administration is we're going to start to think about walking back from that. It's not clear if you think that China's cheating, that that's necessarily the way to get them to change their behavior.
An argument from the left over the years against many free trade agreements is that we have environmental standards here, minimum wage standards, maybe labor protections here.
Yeah.
The people making this argument say those are good things, but they raise the cost of production. So a country we're competing with that doesn't have those things has a built-in advantage.
Yes, and that's true. And, you know, we think about trade-offs when we think about the politics and economics of international trade. That is part of why some countries have lower costs of production overseas. If you think about a Vietnam or a China producing textiles or sneakers or something overseas. But in general, the U.S., you know, as an industrialized country, we're abundant in capital, we're abundant in human capital, have a very highly educated workforce, that our comparative advantage in international trade is in services and high-end manufacturing and things like that. And developing countries are labor abundant, they're resource abundant, that they have a comparative advantage, and they would probably still have a comparative advantage in those things, even if they had, you know, higher labor standards. And it's not to say normatively that we shouldn't pursue higher labor standards and environmental standards in trade agreements, but having those in trade agreements wouldn't bring all of those jobs back to the United States.
I think you touched on something that's been a big issue in the politics of the last year or two. We have a highly educated workforce that can do some of these high-end, high-value things. Not everybody is in that category, and
yes,
the jobs that are hurt by trade, I think it's fair to say, they're the ones that the person with a lower level of training or a lower level of education could have gone to and gotten a decent living. The bad effects of trade are disproportionately on this group of people.
Yes, and we think about high-skilled versus low-skilled labor, or, you know, capital benefiting but labor not. And that's definitely true, and that's the difficult political trade-off is if you want the aggregate benefits in terms of economic growth and benefits to consumers in terms of price and variety of goods, you're going to get that with international trade, but you're going to get these tensions that some people are winning and some people are losing. And then that gets into, you know, interesting and tense domestic political debates about policies to compensate the losers, to retrade them. Should we expand social welfare programs and things of that sort? Closing off international trade might help those people, right? Might save jobs in those sectors of the economy and in certain firms in the United States, but then you're going to lose the benefits of international trade. So unfortunately, there's no free lunch where we can have all of the benefits but none of the costs.
Mark Koplovich is with us right now. He's an associate professor of political science and public affairs at UW-Madison, with us to talk about NAFTA and free trade and answer your questions. You can share your thoughts and questions now at 800-642-1234. As NAFTA is renegotiated, what do you think needs to change? Do you think it's been a net benefit or cost to the United States, to your community, to you? What are your general thoughts or questions about international trade and the agreements that relate to it? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Mark Koplovich. He is Associate Professor of Political Science and Public Affairs at UW-Madison. We're talking about international trade, NAFTA, the World Trade Organization, and other issues in free trade. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about trade? What are your thoughts on NAFTA, whether the United States should renegotiate it, get out of it, as the president has threatened in some cases? If you work in manufacturing or farming, how do you see international trade affecting you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. To your calls now. Katie is with us in Sparta. Katie, hi.
Hi. My name is Katie, and in 2005, as part of a study abroad, I went to Mexico, and as part of that visit, I was able to meet with a group of Zapatistas who were, it's a group that formed January 1st, 1994, after Emiliano Zapata, that's, they're named after Emiliano Zapata, the group's leader, and they were formed in response to NAFTA going through in Mexico. And one of the unique things that I got to do was not only meet with this community that was against NAFTA, but also meet with an economist. And one thing that I noticed is they just didn't have the technology there. So when they're sowing corn, they're doing it by hand. And they're doing so many things by hand because they just don't have the technology. And when NAFTA came about, their exports, such as their corn and any other goods that come from the country, that tax, you know, the free trade eliminated their tax base, or eliminated a lot of their tax base. And that's, I mean, if you look at the economy of Mexico, there's a pretty sharp decline.
Katie, I want to jump in and give our guest a chance to respond. And a lot of countries around the world are not happy with U.S. agricultural exports and agricultural subsidies that help make those possible. Can you talk a little about how that plays out in NAFTA, Mark?
Yeah, so I think what Katie is talking about is actually, you know, identifying that for Mexico as well, there are these domestic winners and losers from trade. So, you know, American agriculture is actually competitive in export markets, and Mexican agriculture in certain sectors, as Katie alluded to, may not have benefited. But there were a lot of jobs created in northern Mexico with American auto companies coming in and setting up plants. And so again, you have, you know, this idea of specialization and comparative advantage. Trade is benefiting Mexico as a whole, and it's leading to job creation in some sectors, but it's actually taking away jobs in other sectors. And we see this across countries, the proper nouns of which sector or which industry are benefiting and losing from trade, and which geographies are benefiting and losing differ. But these tensions we see in every country when we're talking about globalization.
Some people would argue that the beneficiary in that situation is the auto company, who gets to pay less for workers, and maybe the big food companies that are, it's not the workers ultimately, it's the corporations that get this international flexibility to cut costs.
Which is true, but then it's also by extension American consumers, right? Because you're lowering the cost of production of automobiles, and then, you know, American consumers, Mexican consumers, Canadian consumers are getting cars produced, you know, more efficiently at lower cost. And that's the difficult discussion, right? So that is great as a consumer, but if the GM plant is closing, right, in Janesville or, you know, in Ohio, then you have these, you know, parts of the country that are saying this is not working for us.
Katie, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Tristan in Appleton. Tristan, hi.
Hello. So first off of all, I'm a political science student from UW Oshkosh. And I'd just like to say that I think we need to also keep in mind that this, like Trump's talk about free trade deals, comes in with the America First idea. So I think geopolitically, we need to keep in mind as well that there tends to be a sort of parent country protecting free trade, like, you know, keeping countries safe so that they can protect it. So I think in connection with, like, the U.S. pulling back a little bit militarily from across the planet, we've seen the lowest troop count since Vietnam around the country or around the world. So I think we need to keep that in mind. This is also a bit in connection with the U.S. wanting to be less involved with world politics in general.
Tristan, thanks a lot for the call. The U.S. Bearing the cost as the world's policeman is the phrase. we pay a lot as Americans in a way to guarantee free trade in some ways. Is that right?
Yeah. So we, you know, the term we use to think about this in political science is hegemony. Right, that you have a hegemon, which is the most powerful state in the international system, is bearing the burden of providing an open trade and financial system, of providing international security, a nuclear umbrella, right, helping out our NATO allies, intervening in military affairs around the world, and that we do that in part for the stability of the system, but in part for selfish benefits that we benefit overwhelmingly. I think the point is very well taken that the Trump administration's approach to international trade is part of a broader approach to international relations, that cooperation and mutual gains and the United States bearing this burden, even though we benefit the most, that we need to pull back and we need to focus on America first. And so you can't separate the security and the economic implications.
Tristan, thanks for the call. We'll go next to David in Madison. David, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I just you haven't said anything about balance of trade. Mm-hmm. The United States has been running a balance of trade deficit, about $40 billion a month for probably a generation or two. Mm-hmm. And doesn't that amount to a huge transfer of wealth from this country as they, with the surplus, the other countries are able to buy into our stock market, into our buy real estate here.
Got it, David. We're low on time, Mark.
Yes. Yeah, so, the difficulty is there are actually two sides to the national balance sheet. So you have the current account, which is the trade balance and government spending, and then you have the capital account. And they're mere images of each other. So we are running a trade deficit with the rest of the world. What that means is there's a net inflow of capital into the United States. And that is good for the country, right? That is foreign money coming into the country, investing in the United States, financing American consumption. And it's very difficult for a country which issues the world's reserve currency. The U.S. dollar is about two-thirds of global foreign exchange reserves. People want to hold dollars all around the world. So it's very difficult, actually, for us to run a trade surplus with all of that money coming in. And this is something that the Trump administration, I think, misses, that there's a capital flow side that might be contributing to trade balances. It's not just we're spending more on the trade side and that we're losing.
We'll leave it there. Mark, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Thank you so much.
We've been talking about NAFTA and U.S. trade deals in general with Mark Koplovich. He's an associate professor of political science and public affairs at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.